Okay. No, I'm on, I guess. All right. Thank you for the invitation to speak here, and thank you for the promotion to the Fields Institute. I feel very honored, and I think that in honor of that, I will try to make a more or less self-contained talk, and I have to apologize in advance. I have too many transparencies, and I'll be tempted to show them all. So, and I missed the first one already, so just a sec. The talk is about an experiment and or a couple of experiments about rotating fluids, and I'll divide the talk into three parts. First, I'm going to mention the experiment and what's happening in the experiment, a few of the observations. There are some classical experiments and a modern experiment. Then I'll mention a few words about some theory that has been done, and then I'll jump into completely incomprehensible stuff that I'm going to try to explain. There will be three results, one, and I'll mention them at a time. So the classical experiment of Taylor, actually, that you can find in Chandrasekhar's book on hydrodynamic and hydromagnetic turbulence, stability. Do we have a pointer of any sort? Otherwise, I'm going to go here. A stick or something. Anyway, so in this experiment, a solid cylinder, maybe with a core, I don't care, is rotated slowly, and the die is inserted. And what is observed is that points that initially are separated by a certain distance remain separated by, roughly speaking, the same distance. So distance doesn't, between two vertically separated points, doesn't change in time. Also, the motion remains in sheets parallel to the vertical rotation axis. So this is the so-called Taylor-Proudhon theorem, and it is not so-called. It is a theorem, but it is a very simple theorem. It says that if the velocity is very small and you therefore neglect the nonlinear term, so u times u is small, the flow is steady, so you neglect the u dt. Viscosity is not present, so you neglect the Laplacian. Then the flow becomes two-dimensional. And actually here you have a proof of this thing, because if you throw everything else, what you are left is a balance between pressure and the rotation, the Coriolis term. And thank you, sir. So my point like so. Brilliant. Thank you. So you get a balance between rotation and the Coriolis force and the gradient of pressure. This is in a frame rotating with the fluid. And this pi contains the centrifugal force. So it's a physical pressure plus some centrifugal term there that is proportional to omega, but you don't see it in this writing up. So if these things are balanced plus divergence free, a little calculation that everybody can do gives you that the vertical velocity cannot depend on z, and then boundary conditions make it zero. So this is the Taylor-Proudhon theorem. And the Taylor-Proudhon theorem that I'm going to show you is going to be essentially exactly this when you allow for this term and the time derivative. So you allow for these two things, and the statement will be the same, that the Lagrangian displacement, honest Lagrangian transformation that takes you from two dots that initially are separated vertically to later two dots, will go down, so the vertical displacement will remain asymptotically constant as omega goes to infinity. And we have actually a better description than that. Mainly, we have a result that says if you take a time step, how much do they move? You have bounds from above, bounds from below. The whole thing is pretty simple. And you need to remember that there are two main, in this particular presentation here, you see two parameters, nu and omega. And associated to them, there are two non-dimensional numbers. One is the Rossby number, which is a measure of the ratio. It's a time scale ratio, actually. The time scale of rotating rigidly because you're rotating the thingy, and the time scale of internal vortices relative to this rotation. So the curl of velocity is a rotation of the relative velocity, and in situations of geophysical significance, this Rossby number is around 10 to minus 2. And there is also the Ekman number, which is related to the fact that you have a very thin boundary layer at the bottom and perhaps at the top also that has to do the viscous transition, where the viscous transition to essentially what would like to be a rigid motion occurs very on the very tiny, so it's much smaller. All right. The other experiment that I don't know if I have transparency. Yes, I do. The other experiment, the much more recent experiment, is an experiment of Harry Sweeney's. And I think I have, this is one of the transparencies I have on that. And what he does is the same kind of apparatus. You rotate rigidly, so it's not there are famous experiments in which you rotate differentially. You rotate the inner, let's say, a cylinder, but you keep the outer wall of the cylinder fixed, and that creates a shear. That particles stick to the steady thing, they stick to the rotating thing, so then they are sheared. There is no shear induced, so the thing is rotating steadily, and you cannot see it, but I can draw it to you. There is a radius here. What happens is that he forces the system. He forces the system from below. So he pumps in water and sucks in water, also at the bottom plate. That's nothing to the top plate. And the top plate is rigid. So this forces a certain flow. And this flow creates quasi-two-dimensional structures that are born, grow. You see here one of the vortices that are born, grow, and then die. So they have a little dance of vortices that grow. These are presumably motions that have a planar nature after some boundary condition. And he measures, among other things, the things that I can address, and I'm making sure that you hear this now because I don't know if I'm going to get to it. He measures the spectrum. So that's the Fourier transform squared of the signal and some velocity components. And he gets and proves, you know, beyond doubt that there is a K minus 2 power spectrum as opposed to K minus 5/3 power spectrum. And this spectrum, so these wave numbers K, live to the left. So smaller wave numbers, larger scales, to the left of the injection scale. And the injection scale is the size of the little holes through which he pushes the fluid. So you are actually forcing this fluid at relatively small physical scales, and something happens, and then you get a spectrum, and the spectrum is unexpected from some points of view. This minus 5/3 is so-called Krachmann inverse cascade. Yes, sir?
Wouldn't you expect the minus 2 just because you have a jump in vorticity?
Minus 2 is minus 1 in the jump in vorticity, I thought.
This is
the energy. Yes, the energy spectrum. So it is not. He had trouble publishing this. Okay, so it's not. It's not an acceptable theory. There were some difficulties in the inverse cascade theory predicted a minus 5/3. The minus 2. There is no real good theory. What I'm going to show you is a theorem that if you take a certain model, you get a minus 2 upper bound. Okay, but I cannot tell you that I have a theorem that says that certain model applies to this physical situation. Okay, so in some sense, I take the view that we have a plethora of models, and one way to distinguish between them is whether or not their mathematics agrees with what is seen in real life. So that would be a result that I hope to get to, hopefully, towards the end. And the Taylor-Couette thing is another result. In between, I'm going to talk about vortex reconnection just briefly because we talked over at lunch. So in math, the good question. This is appearing now in dynamics, continuous, and discrete dynamical systems in the volume in honor of Vishik, which is probably in press right now. So a good question is, okay, I'm rotating things. Everybody understands that somehow this has to become a two-dimensional field. Why is it? Okay? And there have been traditional answers here, and the basic methodology goes like so. So it's one of the earliest papers are by Embid and Maida, but they're in the spirit of averaging in ODEs, which is a very well-established method. You have this rotation term, the capital omega, the Coriolis force term, is an anti-symmetric term. Let's put it here with an L, and with a large parameter. Then you have some nonlinearity. And then they do an expansion in two timescales, and a timescale, a slow timescale associated with the actual relative motion of the fluid, and a fast timescale having to do with the rotation of the tank, as it were. And then they discuss results about weak convergence having to do with averaging out the fast scales. So if there are no resonances, you are looking at the representation of the solution in a frame that moves with, you throw away the nonlinearity, you have a linear propagator that's actually dispersive, e to the I omega something. The something depends on k in a way that every time you are going to have non-resonance, this thing was going to go away because omega goes to infinity. So what survives are only the resonant terms, and those turn out to be two-dimensional. So results of this sort have been done by Babin, Mahalov, and Nikolaenko with periodic vertical conditions, which are a little artificial, in which they get a lot of non-trivial resonances, and they do this in strong norms. These Embid and Maida do weak convergence. And then much more recently, a group of French guys did the viscous case for and got strong convergence in the whole space. And that invokes the viscosity, and the rotation has to be exponentially smaller than the viscosity. So it's for a very, 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 very strong rotation. And the statement is, uses the fact that the velocity of the Navier-Stokes by then, in these very, very, very long time scales, is practically zero. So you are using the fact that you are going to zero in Navier-Stokes. So what I'm going to present is a trivial, really, explanation of what's going on. It's trivial, but unfortunately it requires a little language first. But then if you survive the language, it is trivial. It's a calculation that tells you that the Lagrangian displacement goes down. Okay? Vertical Lagrangian displacement goes down. So now comes the unintelligible part, okay? So I'm going to talk about, first of all, changing variables, okay, from Lagrangian to Eulerian and back. But then I'm going to allow the change of variables to be diffusive, and that's not something that people do normally, meaning that I'm not going to, that I'm going to put a Laplacian in the transformation, in the change of variables. But first, quickly, a review of this change of variable business, and I'm emphasizing now some things that are important for various reasons. So if I change variables from some labels to the laboratory, so I have here, I observe some fluid somewhere, and I label it at initial time, I have a transformation that the direct transformation from labels to the laboratory is the Lagrangian map, and the inverse transformation is called A back to labels. It's just inverse Lagrangian map. And it has two effects incorporated in that are purely kinematic effects. One of them is the stretching of the fluid element. So the gradient of this map measures how much things stretch. The second derivatives of this map will talk about bending. And in particular, if you start drawing a straight line in the laboratory, this line, if you try to trace it back from where it came from a curvy line. And the fact that this is a geodesic in the standard space under this change of variables is written with some coefficients which are related to the second derivative of this map, and that those are the Christoffel coefficients. These objects will enter later some dynamics. Okay, so you are still okay with me? This is slide one of maybe three painful slides. Okay, slide two is I'm going to use four descriptions of the same fluid. In reality, there are only two. So again, we compare labels and laboratory map, and we have the usual Eulerian velocity called u that is in this corner. And this usual Eulerian velocity, you imagine flow past the point. You stick a point in a lab, you measure some particles passing your fluid passing by, you measure their velocity, that's called u of x, and x is the point that's fixed. You can talk in the labels at marking a particle and following the trajectory of the marked original initial velocity of that initial particle and following that as the particle goes. Okay? This is called v. V is not, it's a little technical thing, v is also a function of x. Okay? It's the original velocity composed with a. In that, in this case. And then there is the curl of the rotational, the curl of u, and there is the curl with respect to labels of v called zeta. These guys are related to each other by some formula if you are going to do the same fluid. The first formula tells you how to compute the velocity u from the virtual velocity v if you know the transformation A. And that's simply taking a gradient, transpose the gradient, and do a projection on divergence free. Okay? What? V is the initial velocity composed with, V is responsible only for rearrangement. So V is the initial velocity frozen in the fluid. V is the initial velocity frozen in the fluid, so it's a reference velocity that you mark some particles, and then you follow the particles and carry the same information. A is the back to, so it's the inverse of Lagrangian map. So A tells you which label X came from. Okay? And V says I have V of X is the velocity at X that was my original velocity at location A. Okay? If you had a stochastic process, then the expected value of V would be something of interest, would maybe give you the present velocity in some sense. So in analogous to this thing, there is a Cauchy formula that tells you how to compute the present-day vorticity, the curl of u in laboratory, in terms of the frozen-in Cauchy invariant, which is the vorticity at some time recorded at, and then moved around by the flow. Okay? So these two formulas, you don't need to remember them, but they tell you there is this little diagram. I can start with V. I can apply the formula, take an honest curl down, or I can take a V, take an honest curl in labels down, and apply Cauchy, and this little dance around the roses occurs. Okay? Now, I've said all this in the inviscid case. I'm going to not say it, but say it in the viscous case, exactly the same thing. So in the inviscid case, it's perfectly okay. In the viscous case, it's something that I declare. So I'm going to use the same formalism, exact same formalism, with maps that are diffusive. So all these transformations are given by formulae, so I know what I'm talking about, okay? So I have a transparency that I'm not going to show unless people ask me, so don't ask. And I'm going to tell you now about dynamics. So I'm down to painful number three. I think I lied. I think there were maybe four painful ones. Or even more. Who knows? So corresponding to this thing, there is dynamics. Okay. So in each representation, you are familiar with the Euler or Navier-Stokes equations in the U representation. They have some equations that many people know. And if those who don't know by now, they don't need to know. And there is a representation in vorticity. Similar representations are in V and in zeta. Here is the V representation. You have an equation for V that says I advect and diffuse. These are regular derivatives, or Eulerian derivatives with respect to x. And then I acquire another gradient term, another drift term, if you wish, that has to do with the geometry. The C is the transparency that I didn't tell you, but it is related to the Christoffel symbol. Second derivative, yes, ma'am? Here it is. You start with a, you advect it. So you do exactly the same thing. If nu equals 0, A, you can think of it as simply I'm advecting labels starting from the identity transformation. Here am I advecting and diffusing. So I'm doing advection, and I do also diffusion of the labels from the identity. I do that for some time, then I stop, start again. It will be invertible for short times. It simply start with the, its gradient is in identity at time 0. For a while, it's invertible. After that, I stop. Because you can, I'll show you why. I'll show you transparency number 4. I'll tell you the equation for the determinant. Okay, actually, reconnection. That's why it's not inverse. So reconnection equals that. Okay? So these are the things. So actually, okay, result number 3. I said I'm going to mention 3 results. Fast reconnection is the loss of invertibility of this map. Okay, now that's, I said a mouthful because I don't know what fast reconnection is, but I can define it to be that. But I will give you, however, some quantity that you can monitor that will be an indication of fast reconnection, and then numerical results of Kojo Kitani that went into the field and checked that that's consistent at least. Okay, so you didn't ask me about the C. There is something there. Now I'll tell you a little more about this. So how am I for time? We go till 2 o'clock? What do we do? Okay. So I'll run out of time very fast, but I think that this is relatively important. So let me say this, although it's not about rotating fluids yet. So you have, of course, something in the zeta quarter, some equation that you don't need to look. It looks pretty much the same as before because I didn't tell you how the coefficients dance here. It's the same type. You remember, when nu equals 0, this is simply advection. It tells you that the Cauchy invariant is an invariant. It doesn't change on fluid particles. And these, there is one more field here called the velocity by Bathke, magnetic momentum for some reason by some people, impulse by others, and it's a mixed field. It's not really, it's a mixed metaphor. It's something that is neither purely Eulerian nor purely Lagrangian, and it's the gradient of the transformation applied. So it's a thing before I project. And it sits in between, and it has its own equation, which looks very nice, but the equation is not good. And the next statement takes me a little bit away, but I'll say it because, as I said, it makes contact with some body of literature. If you apply filters, if you want to really compute this, you need to do something in order to compute. And one thing to do is to filter the advecting velocity. Okay? And you have this Mary diagram that it doesn't really matter where you are. Everything is okay. You can choose your own description. If you apply filters, the diagram is broken. So these 4 guys are essentially versions of a vortex method. So if you look here, it's going to be a vortex method. If you're looking, going to look here, it's going to be some sort of an alpha equation, one of the Daryl Holm average equations. So all these are, the velocity U is the so-called Leray equation. It's a different equation, and they have different properties. So they separate. But the this surviving 4, this is filtered Kuzminov-Seledets or averaged Euler equations, filtered vorticity, which is a vortex method, and then there are, of course, these 2 unnamed cousins. So these things do exist. So I'll go one little step about the stopping and resetting, and then I'm going to show a transparency about this determinant. So this looks horrible, but it's actually very simple. So let's call it a factorization, the process by which you iterate this thing. So you solve the equation. This is your diffusive field. This is your velocity field, as it were, the virtual velocity. And this is a nonlinear equation, but it's easily solved because of the presence of the filter. You solve it for some short time. At the end of this, with initial data identity for the map and some initial data velocity at something, and then you solve for some time. At the end of that time, you harvest new initial data. And the new initial data is whatever you got in the velocity field, you put as your new velocity, and you reset the mapping to identity, and you continue. And the theorem says that this gives you, first of all, in the absence of a filter, it gives you the honest solutions. And if you have a filter, then it gives you the merry commuting diagram. So this is a computation at the southwest corner of the diagram, but you can compute in this fashion at any of the four corners of the diagram, and you're computing the real thing then, with a given filter. Also, you can guarantee, very pessimistically, how long can you take the time step. So there is some theorem that tells you something like this, that tells you that if I have a factorization, and if I know something about its vorticity, then I get very strong bounds for the departure from identity for the matrix gradient A and for this virtual things, and these bounds are in analytic spaces. They're very strong. So it tells you how large should be the time step which is related to this object, and you can place a free parameter G. So, in other words, you can control this as long as the vorticity doesn't blow up. You can do it for all. Normally, if you don't know anything, then this thing will depend on your filter. But if you know that the solution is smooth, then it doesn't depend on the filter, and you get bounds for those. And here is the transparency about the reconnection. If you look at the, so you want to think of what I said here. You want to think of this factorization as a chart. You're like in a manifold. You're solving an equation in which the physical quantities can be replaced by virtual quantities, this transformation of the Lagrangian quantity and the V. And whenever you feel uncomfortable with your chart, you can change it. And you're still always monitoring the same physical quantities. This chart has a compressible element depending on viscosity, because after all, I'm diffusing particles. And the equation for the log of the determinant of gradient A is given by this second order term related to the Christoffel symbol. This has units of 1 over length, so the square has an units of 1 over length square. This is a time scale. Okay? And in reality, really, if you initialize this problem and look at the time it takes for the gradient to actually, the determinant to go to 0, that's a threshold in the calculation. And it's indicative of the reconnection process in the sense that, so let me show you maybe, if I have it, a calculation. You're going to reset. I don't know if the picture matches the. So you are resetting the calculation according to where the gradient matrix acquires a zero determinant. And you'll notice that you have to reset much more often in certain times. And also, that's, of course, related to this the right-hand side of the equation for the determinant, which is nu times c square. And c square also starts becoming very large because there is very large curvature to the particle trajectories at certain times. Then you go in the fluid. This is a calculation of two vortex rings. So it's a actually not a vortex ring, sorry. It's a classical calculation in Zabowski and Pell's early calculation. It's in two columnar vortices. They did this calculation with hyperviscosity. This is with normal viscosity. And at some times, you go inside and things start reconnecting. And those are the times in which you have to reset. So this needs more much more numerical exploration, but it is a quantitative thing. I don't have to use my eyes to define what a reconnection means. I have a quantitative object that I'm proposing, and then if it really matches what the eye see, then that's a good way of describing theoretically this thing. Yeah?
So this is a kind of a global thing. In practice, you can get reconnection happening in different.
Unfortunately, this is not global. This is a very strict thing, so it's the L-infinity norm. So unfortunately, this is a little too restrictive. It means that anywhere, the first time it happens, I have to stop. So if this invertibility of it's in L-infinity norm. So if the invertibility loses, it's lost in one tiny region that I don't care about even, I have to stop and reset. So actually, I expect that the interesting quantities will be more average than this.
And also, this would give you a way of looking at when the conservation laws are breaking down. So linking number, conservation of linking number breaks down when.
That's a very interesting suggestion. It just so happens that right now there has been a paper talking about the breakdown of the helicity and how helicity can break down before the loss of energy. So it's very interesting. It's very, very, very related. Seems very related. But okay, this is in the future. Now a little bit about rotation. Okay, I mentioned I have actually time to do at least the Taylor-Proudman some sort of a butchery of that. Yes, sir. Absolutely continuous, right? So. I reset when you know you're looking at it's like with the series a continuous thing, but if I project in some direction, at some point I get I should change the projection because I get an infinity. So that's what we're dealing with. It's a chart. So
even though so the first time two
so right,
cross,
right, 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 right. So it's very difficult. This is why conceptually it's very difficult to define a reconnection because it is really some process, continuous process in a diffusive thing, and you start with things that are unlinked and you end up changing or linked and you change up. At the end of the process, it's clear that you have done something that's topologically different. In the process itself, it's a continuous process. So how are you going to define that? You can say by initial state has different topology than last state. Here we're talking about actually trying to go inside and parameterize the time steps or the in-between regions in which there is a minimal number or some degree of.
But it defines a natural time scale.
But it does define a time scale that is not about a discrete process. And indeed, reconnection has its own time scales. And this new time C square is a time scale.
So you could rescale, do some sort of asymptotic analysis on the short time scale and focus in on the.
I hope so. So it hasn't been done. But you can also compare this diagnostic with actual processes, physical processes. In particular, in plasmas, you have a numerical quantity that you can monitor, and you have also the observational data that there is a reconnection that are very fast. And then you can actually attempt to, without theory, to match the two.
If you set the velocity to zero, you get an
There is no reconnection, right? So this is not an inviscid reconnection because that would require something called weak solutions for the Euler equations, and in 3D we have a notion of some very very weak solutions, but those don't have this feature. So yeah, it is about a process that I believe happens because of magnetic reconnection, magnetic diffusivity in MHD or viscosity, but the small scales present in the fluid are responsible for it. Rotation. The same thing works with rotation. Okay, so what happens is that what changes is the Weber formula, this W. It looks horrible. It's down here. It acquires, so this, the old formula will look like this, and it has a little gradient here to make it divergence-free. It acquires another term having to do with the rotation and having to do with the fact that there is now a preferred direction called z-hat and the maps A, and this is labels, as it were, and present x. So there is some formula, okay? And this also gives you a natural formula for the Cauchy invariant. There is some formula there. It looks bad, so they start looking bad for a while, okay, but by the time I'm done with them, it will be very nice. So the Cauchy formula is the old Cauchy formula that without rotation by plus some term, And the term is some matrix nonlinear in the displacement, A minus X. Remember, this is back to labels, this is labels. So some term, okay? So it gives you the same structure of the equation, the same whole thing. Now, if you really are going to do exact calculations, which is easier, or you can do this with viscosity, it's going to be a little more horrendous. But now I'm going to jump in because of time. So let me not jump because of time. So if you are going to do a calculation with no viscosity, you have additional relations that have to do with the determinant being 1. And if you do those relations, you can compute this correction, as it were, to the Cauchy formula, and it has a certain expression. And when you disentangle this expression, okay, it's as trivial as that, you get the following statement that embodies the nonlinear Taylor problem theorem with no theorem. It's a statement. And it's the following. Consider simply the honest Lagrangian displacement. This is the label. This is where it got. Okay, the transformation. I call that lambda. The L was, the inverse of that, as it were, right? So lambda is really the displacement between label and where it got. There is a time-independent relationship. A3 is the vertical direction. It tells you the vertical direction of lambda, the time derivative of that, is proportional to the Rossby number, local Rossby number. That's it. So it's a derivative with respect to labels in terms of the initial reference vorticity divided by omega. And it equals a change in vorticities. This is theta, really, in the Lagrangian form. This is the frozen vorticity and the initial vorticity, also divided by omega. So if I call, this really is stronger than any theorem I'm going to state after this. This is behind any theorem. It tells you that the vertical derivative of the Lagrangian displacement vanishes like so when omega is large. This is between 2 points, 3D rotating Euler's, nothing. No boundary conditions, nothing. This is essentially a consequence of the structure of the equations. You can, there is no dynamics in the sense that I'm using the transformations that will be carried by the dynamics, but nothing else, okay? There is no resonances, there is no skew symmetric operators, there is nothing. There is straightforward staring at the equation. And you stare at the equation and you see that if I'm going to increase this, I'm going to go to zero. So let's show some consequences of this that are pretty straightforward. So the first one is exactly what Taylor was saying. You mark two particles. You take two particles, P and Q, separated by a vertical distance, so the difference between them is parallel to the rotation axis, and you measure the later position, and you get a inequality here, which if there is no infinity, and you measure it not infinitely later, so everything is now time dependent and so forth, this object will be vanishing with Rossby number, linearly with Rossby number, so you are getting actually the thing didn't, the vertical displacement didn't change. Because Rossby goes to zero. So, the for a lower bound, so this says that if I start with two particles and I measure them, I'm going to repeat some of the same thing. I measure the displacement after a finite time, I can tell you how much the distance between them, vertical distance, has changed. And it has to do with, of course, how fast are the relative motions. If the relative motions, that will give me an amplification. And then that's multiplied by the Rossby number. And that gives me a decrease. Suppose I have two, so now for lower bounds. So this was saying how far they can separate. And how can, sounds like the same thing, but I have to do it separately. How far can they get apart, can get together? So imagine that I have two surfaces, parallel surfaces I'm going to carry by the flow, and I'm asking myself how fast, how long can I compute without them pinching, without them actually have one penetrated the other vertically. So suppose I define the vertical separation to be the infimum of the vertical distance between two elements in the one surface and the other, and dt is just the distance. So I assume initially that the distance is positive. See, the distance is smaller because the surfaces could be close in the vertical, closer in the vertical than in, you know, some regions could be next together. So suppose I start with positive distance. For simplicity, imagine that they are separated vertically. They're parallel. Okay? And suppose the Rossby number is less than a quarter. And suppose I take a time step so that this displacement didn't do more than a quarter. Okay? The quarters are my choice. I can do other numbers, but strictly less than one, so I still have an invertible matrix. Then the distance between the surfaces is bounded below by the original distance and 1 over 14, the Rossby number. Rossby number going to 0 implies they didn't get any closer. They're still at the same distance. So in order to get to 0, you obviously have some mechanism. So these are just simply direct consequences of that observation. And finally, the direct consequence is just as trivial, is the theorem that you have a two-dimensional flow in the end. So because I want to state a theorem, I'm going to limit the time of evolution just to get everything a priori. But you could say the same theorem by assuming that there is no singularity for some time. Okay? So the theorem is I start initial data that are smooth enough, 5/2, which is a very natural thing, periodic. And then, of course, there exists a time, which is the local time existence that's uniform in rotations. And I take a sequence of rotations that goes to infinity, then there will be a subsequence, and so that the Lagrangian transformations associated with the Euler solution will converge to something, and that something will depend on only two labels, okay? So a modulo the identity, right? So it becomes could be a three-dimensional flow, but it depends on two variables. So it could be three components, but it depends on two variables. Okay? So is the statement clear? I look at the Lagrangian transformations at time t for short time, so it's guaranteed that nothing happens, and then they look like in the vertical direction I do nothing, right? I change nothing. And the horizontal direction I change something. Yes, sir? Yeah, I have linear rate, unfortunately. Unfortunately, it is all trivial, so meaning that I'm so short a time that I'm making that calculational observation. I'm going to take all the quantities and bound them by constant independent of omega, and then I'm going to look at the vertical derivative of the lambda. I use that formula, and the right-hand side is bounded all times 1 over omega. So it's linear, but it's nothing. This is really a trivial theorem. It's just simply the observation. Okay? So I do have 5 minutes, so I'm going to mention. So this was number two. Number one was kind of like the reconnection thing. Number two is the Taylor problem, and now let me say something about spectra in 5 minutes, Mr. Sweeney's experiment. So here is a picture, mercifully, about spectra. So you have, as I said, quadratic expressions in the Fourier transform, time averaged. And those in 3D Navier-Stokes are supposed to go, this is the logarithmic, of course, scale, like -5/3 for some reason, and then cut off. In 2D Navier-Stokes, there will be supposedly two regimes. A regime in which you have a -3 exponent for the entropy, a so-called direct cascade, and there is an inverse cascade. The direct and inverse refer to where they are located to the forces. The Fourier transform of the forces is around here, and also to the direction in which the dynamic supposedly goes. So the -5/3, and in Sweeney's experiment, the -5/3 is replaced by -2. And so this is the paper, anomalous cell similarity. And I call it Sweeney, but it's actually Baru, Plapp, Zensusher, and Sweeney. And I'll mention just the result. I have exactly 4 minutes. We have done some, it is possible to do results in the direct cascade regime. So this is kind of like the regular spectrum. It's a little bit Paley energy spectrum as opposed to the honest energy spectrum, but they are really the same thing. And then you can prove for Navier-Stokes equations in 2D an upper bound near the dissipation scale. So this is for large K. And you can prove with the correct exponent. You can prove an upper bound for 3D Navier-Stokes if you assume something that implies regularity for those solutions. Then you can obtain an upper bound with the correct minus 5/3, the Kolmogorov minus 5/3, again, in the dissipation region. So this is for Ks that are close to the dissipation. So it's not really a very deep result. In the QG, this is a new Fizeev letter that appeared of mine. And if you do the QG model, which is a different model, quasi-geostrophic surface, quasi-geostrophic equation, which is not really derived for Sweeney's experiment. I can talk to you about that. Then you get an upper bound of K minus 2, but you get it for low wave numbers. You get it for all the way. Of course, K minus 2 near K equals 0 becomes unbearably generous, so yes, of course. But it does hold in the regions starting from KF to the left with a constant that does not depend on anything but what's written here, which is this is the Fourier, this is the pumping vertical velocity, as it were, and this is the total energy of the system, and that's the amplitude of the forcing. So I think on time, I think that unless you want to know what the LP spectrum is, I think I'll stop here. Okay.
And so, and previously we were saying a lot about deconnection and so on. Well, k to the minus 2 is consistent with vortex sheet. Is that what you expect?
This is two-dimensional flow, really. What happens physically in this flow is you have an Ekman layer, very, very, so remember this is, the pumping is not characteristic. You pump in and out. The boundary conditions at the bottom are non-trivial. Okay, so you're pumping in and pumping out. So there is a very narrow boundary layer, an Ekman layer, in which there is jets that form, this vertical jet turns. And then there are these jets that form, and then after that, the flow becomes two-dimensional. So you're going to see two-dimensional structures, and they're dominated by essentially growing vortex patches, so they're dynamics, and they're so in that sense, well, a vortex sheet in two dimensions corresponds to vortex lines, and that would mean that essentially you would have vorticity dominated by jumps in the vorticity over lines. So you have essentially non-vortical. That's an extreme idealization. So I don't know if that's, it's consistent, but it's not all that he sees. But, you know, it's not, so there is vortical flow in the bulk, which would not, I mean, it cannot be carried only by lines. There is vortical flow in the bulk. There are cyclones, anticyclones, they merge.
But the spectrum should be dominated by the stronger.
Maybe, yeah. So, I mean, maybe.
Because what would be interesting then is one idea of normal homogeneous isotropic turbulence is that initially you have sheets that then you have a K to the minus 2 spectrum at early times, and then these sheets become unstable and roll up or something. And so you could argue that some of these boundary conditions are keeping the flow in a kind of early state. I mean, that's just speculative.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. These are steady state calculations. They're very long time dynamics. The boundary conditions are really small, relatively small scale, just 8 Ekman lengths. So a relatively small scale forcing, very strong forcing, and they have a certain peculiar form of turbulence because it's self-similar. Yes?
Now, in two dimensions, the vorticity is the scale up.
Yes.
So your vorticity time, the connection time scale, now that you don't have so at least the lines themselves don't curve anymore. So what then do
Okay, so we're getting into a different thing here. The two-dimensional structures that indeed change in this experiment are regions of, let's say, semi-constant potential vorticity. You have potential vorticity in the system that's quasi-conserved. I presume the same analysis applies. So I presume that the fact that they change topology, again, it has to do with some dissipation. But the model that I'm using is not 2D Navier-Stokes. It has a different dissipation, very different dissipation. This quasi-geostrophic dissipation is a pseudo-differential operator of order one. But in principle, in principle, there should be something akin to dissipation-induced change of topology, much harder to quantify. There is no formalism like that for this other dissipation. It's only for the Laplacian that you can do these exact formulas. Yeah?
I wanted to clarify some of the logic.
Okay.
The full 3D problem, which in the large rotation limit collapses to a 2D problem.
Right.
And your last theorem says that for a quasi-geostrophic model, you have a statement about a spectrum.
Right.
What is the relevance?
The QG model is a 2D model. So the QG model, okay, so the logic is like this. We are not talking about a Taylor problem. Taylor problem result is about 3D Euler, okay? We're talking about 2D problem. What is that 2D problem? Well, good question. Actually, this transparency here was saying that the 2D Navier-Stokes and the spectra for 2D Navier-Stokes, here is the 2D model. The spectra for 2D Navier-Stokes are different than the spectra for this model. The general quasi-2D model looks like this. The calculation that I did is a particular one, but it will be under certain condition gives you the same spectrum for the full general. So you have a quantity that ignored this beta, the quantity that's essentially advected force and dissipation, advected in the three-dimensional region, and it has boundary conditions, and the boundary conditions have this parameter W. The boundary conditions for a strain function, as it were, or the vertical derivative of the pressure, actually, are the equation that are responsible. Here it is the dissipation, and these are the responsible for the spectrum. So this is a system, quasi-geostrophic system. It's one of the models of what would happen for rotating fluids under certain conditions, certainly not is derived under the conditions of Mr. Sweeney's experiment. However, in the competing model would be 2D Navier-Stokes, let's say. Okay? The Sweeney's observations are consistent with this. This model is also consistent with what people are using actually in geostrophic, in meteorology, if you want, in general. So it's an accepted model. The derivation requires some stratification that I didn't see in the Sweeney model. Maybe it is there, but I didn't see. One second.